Mr. Britt, before we
Sure.
break for lunch? Okay.
Item 21 is the enforcement report. And actually, we have a little more written information ahead of the usual table than we normally have. And I want to mention or just point out a couple of things in that written information. In the on the first page, halfway down, it mentions the outstanding administrative civil liability complaints. The on the GRECA complaint that the regional board's prosecution team has issued, it refers to a bond hearing. That's not correct. It should be a board hearing. This matter in early 2009. I think we're still, as Ms. McChesney and I are the advisory to the board on this, I think we're looking at the possibility of a January, February scheduled date for that. That's still accurate, right? So just to give you an idea of that timing, we're looking at January, February. If it is timely for, say, January, what I was thinking was the possibility of a special board meeting. Normally, we don't have a board meeting in January. However, with the prospect of it being a substantial hearing in terms of the length of time, as well as just the timing in the part of the year, we might want to have a special meeting for that in January. So that remains to be seen. Then the next one that's listed there is the Bardex Corporation one, and that I believe is still on track for our next meeting, October 16th, 17th in Santa Barbara. Again, it remains to be seen whether we'll need a two-day meeting in Santa Barbara, but I did poll you, and it looks like we do have a quorum available if necessary. So we'll see how that agenda shakes out. Western Farm Service, that ACL was settled, as it's described in here. And one of the things that we discussed in terms of delegating authority to me to settle items was to provide a little blurb that just provides a brief description of what the problem was and the settlement itself. So that's what we provided here. And if you want to give me feedback in terms of whether that's adequate or not, or if you'd like to see more or less detail, you can let me know.
I think it's great. I know I was interested in that.
Okay.
And this is exactly what I was looking for. Thanks.
Okay. Then the next item there is the Gilroy Unified School District. That's a construction project. School district hired a contractor. The regional board's prosecution team has issued a complaint on that one. And again, Francis McChesney and I are advisors to you on that one, and we're looking at December for a hearing on that one. Let's see, the men's colony we'll be talking about in item 23, and we have some cards comments on that. And as I mentioned earlier in the meeting, I thought maybe at this point we could discuss the factors regarding Tract 1990. So Harvey Packard is our enforcement coordinator, and I guess he'll kick that off.
Thank you, Harvey Packard, enforcement coordinator. I'll talk a little bit about penalties in general. You're certainly aware that we don't typically do calculations of a specific type when we're setting penalty amounts, other than calculating the maximum allowable penalty. We consider the statutory factors that you're aware of. We consider similar cases both in the region and within the state. We consider what our attorney's saying. We consider the strength of the case. And that's something that doesn't always come through in what you see in front of you. What we give you or what we release to the public in a penalty is usually our best and strongest evidence at what we feel were the facts of the case. What we don't publicize, obviously, are other factors, weaknesses in our evidence and in the things that we have to consider, whether we think we can prove them either here or in court. So it's usually a pretty complicated situation, and in this particular case, it was very complicated. There were a lot of violations. Some of them were pretty serious. But we went through the process, and we came up with an amount that we thought was appropriate for this particular penalty. We think that the settlement is appropriate and fair. It makes a statement both to this particular discharger and to the industry in general, and that's the number that we came up with. We think it's appropriate. We can get into specifics if you're interested, but that's generally what we're...
Yeah, I appreciate that, I assumed all that. That's why I didn't have it pulled. Mm-hmm. But I did want to register my concern that it's difficult to vote on something like that if you don't have all that background. And I know we're
exactly.
not involved in the settlement. And I thought, well, maybe it's a weak case, or maybe there are all these other mitigating circumstances that we're just not privy to. And so I'm just wondering if there's some way, since it is a litigation. Is it be considered litigation?
This is, it's actually a really interesting case. We never issued a complaint here. What we did was we drafted a complaint and all the factors and all the analysis, uh-huh. and then we presented that data to the discharger and said, if we issue a complaint, these are the factors that we consider, and here's the maximum. Mm-hmm. And we invited them to provide what they thought would be an appropriate settlement, and mm-hmm. we went from there, and we reached this amount.
Yeah.
So there was no complaint.
Okay. I mean, I guess my concern is that there's two levels going on here. There's the sort of the behind-the-scenes settlement and the sort of decision on the part of our staff mm-hmm. on what would be a good number. You know, obviously, you want to settle if you can. You're going to avoid, a hearing. At the same time, the other side of that is the public and other people in the industry's perception that, this guy did all these terrible things, and I'm not saying necessarily this case, but in any case, and look, he only got dinged, a couple hundred thousand dollars. Well, I can just, I can eat that. Why should I care?
Right.
So I think there's an interesting balance going on, and I think it's unfortunate. I'm trying to think of a way to sort of, make the penalty actually seem meaningful to the public and to the industry. And I didn't see anything in that where I could say this is why they only got dinged $400,000.
Right.
I've been
struggling with the same types of things.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
With this fairly new process that we're talking about,
and Francis,
it's hard to justify. We can't really justify the settlement without releasing all these details that we wouldn't want to unless we were in a hearing anyway.
I understand. I guess I just want to keep the dialogue going on this.
And I'm kind of curious what the board's role is. When staff has reached a settlement. I mean, how do we review that? We're not involved in those details. Are we to simply make sure it fits within certain bounds? Or are we simply acting as judges? And if two parties have agreed to settle something, is that fine?
Well, in this particular case, you had the option, because it was a settlement presented to you as a stipulated order, that you could agree to it or not agree to it. So
yeah.
Your mechanism would be to say this didn't give enough information to feel comfortable that this amount was correct, so we're not going to agree to it.
And we've done that in the past.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so that would, in this particular case, that would be your mechanism. As far as sort of general feedback about your kinds of concerns you want to be sure are addressed in settlement, I think this is the opportunity to say those are the kinds of concerns, and staff will take that back in their negotiations in the future.
Okay. But I think to echo what Mr. Shawcross was saying, we actually have had more information in prior cases not ones like this that had already settled, but ones that were potentially going to hearing, mm-hmm. in which you had done the calculation of maximum liability, and then had spelled out the calculations that you went through to achieve the final dollar amount. You did that for the staff time. You did it for the economic benefit. But usually what happens is you've got a maximum daily amount per violation. And in effect, what happened here is that the settlement is about an order of magnitude less than the maximum, give or take a little bit. What would be helpful and consistent with past practice is to have a discussion that says that, okay, here's the staff time, here's the economic benefit, here's the maximum liability, instead of $10,000 per violation, we did $1,000 per violation for the remaining amount. And then how does this compare with other violations? We've had other similar kinds of instances, illegal grading and so on, which would then convey that you are being consistent. Also, what we've had in the past is some kind of discussion about if the discharger has shown evidence that they've got religion and that they are doing due diligence to really be much more responsive and responsible, you in the past have discussed that in your presentation of the amounts that you were proposing. So there's no reason why that couldn't, that kind of, without divulging, I think, sensitive negotiations, those kinds of things you could still communicate, which would give the public a better airing of the settlement amount. Mm-hmm. I think it's really not new. It's going back to how you've done it before, and I think that's what Mr. Shawcross and several of us were expecting to see here. Nobody's expecting you to go to the maximum liability. It's often an order of magnitude, sometimes two orders of magnitude down from that, but mm-hmm. usually there's more explanation.
Okay.
Okay. Any other board?
I'll add one thing.
Sure.
It's my understanding that there are other ways that we could or the board could approach these types of settlements. For instance, once the prosecution team and the discharger have reached a proposed settlement, couldn't we involve, say, the chair or even the advisory team in that and get some initial discussion or decision from them about whether it would be appropriate to take it to the whole board?
Yes, in fact, there's an exception to the ex parte rule that if you've reached a settlement, the advisory team can, in fact, discuss that mm-hmm. with the chair. And also the two parties can come to the executive officer and yeah. present their case
right.
for approval. And those would be the ones you've granted the executive officer approval of ones below, $300,000 or below. So that would be the situation there.
Okay.
I'm wondering why in a case like this, since we can't hear about it in closed session, about the settlement. I mean, before it comes to the board in public.
I can check into that. I don't know the
okay.
answer offhand.
I mean, because if we did it in closed session, I think maybe we could hear some, although it wouldn't help the public out, but at least I might feel better, you know, if I heard some of the stuff that you can't divulge. I don't know.
We have some office enforcement attorneys.
Okay, good.
Yeah, my only thought on that issue specifically
and your name is?
Sorry, David Boyers, counsel with the Office of Enforcement. On that issue specifically, I mean, we've got confidential settlement negotiations that have occurred, and I think you would need the approval of both parties to show up and perhaps disclose the manner in which this case proceeded through settlement. Without that, your counsel wouldn't know how the case progressed through negotiations.
Okay.
But that could be done with a teleconference.
Yeah.
You know, with a speakerphone.
Well, I think with the direction that Harvey got from Mr. Press that maybe in the future that this might be addressed. I mean, that might be taken care of. So,
okay.
I'm happy with.
All right, Mr. Briggs, did you have?
No, it's okay.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I was talking about the enforcement report.
Yes.
I had another question on the enforcement report.
I'm not done yet either, so go ahead.
Okay, well, this is a little separate. Wasn't there some discussion somewhere, maybe the state board or somewhere, about each regional board having an enforcement unit?
Yes, we do.
We do? And how big is our enforcement unit?
Well, you just saw half of a unit there.
Well, okay, that's 0.5.
Todd Stanley is our line staff person in the enforcement
unit. Is he full-time?
Yes, and I think he's full-time. We have one vacancy, which we had hoped to fill until the governor instituted a hiring freeze.
Yeah, because this sort of goes back to the whole, what we settle for, because we're always having to take into consideration, hearing's going to take all this time away from people who have other jobs here. And I just think if we had a heftier enforcement people who that's all they did, we might not have to be such wimps on the
strike that.
Or there must be a better way to put that.
Yeah,
I can't think of it at the moment.
Matt Thompson was in our enforcement unit, and now he's leading another unit. And like I said, we intended to fill that position. So we had the two line staff people. Harvey's been our enforcement coordinator. But one thing to keep in mind is that enforcement is not done solely by the enforcement unit. The idea of the enforcement unit was to do the more complex cases, but we expect our line staff to be following up with enforcement within their within their programs for the less complicated cases.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Okay.
So, speaking of less complicated cases, last thing I wanted to mention was the mandatory minimum penalty initiative, which is on bottom of page 2 and on page 3 of this report. And at the time we wrote this, the only information we had as far as the 22 facilities that the Office of Enforcement had contacted in our region as part of this cleanup of mandatory minimum penalties. This is a statewide effort, but in our region we had 22 facilities. So, as it said at the bottom of the table, we had only heard from San Simeon and that they had agreed to pay. I just got an update from Reed Sato, the Office of Enforcement Chief, and the update says that for our region we have 18 of 22 that responded. Five waived a hearing and agreed to pay. Two were okay with that, but pending verification. 11 had legal or technical challenges, which both the Office of Enforcement and our staff are now trying to sort out on those 11. And then that leaves 4 that did not respond at all, and the Office of Enforcement is proceeding with ACLs for those 4. So that's the rundown on the 22. So we got 18 out of 22 responses. However, only 7 of those are really currently resolved. Hopefully a large batch of the 11 with questions will be resolved as well. And that's it for my report. We do have...
I just want to make...
Dr. Hunter,
I just have a question. In looking at the list of facilities, and I noted that it looks like 10 of the 22 listed are wastewater treatment plant violations. I'm just curious, do we know how many wastewater treatment plants we have in our region? Is it?
Of course. They all have permits.
Yeah, well, I know that, but I mean, is there some place where we just look at wastewater treatment plants in the form of annual reports, or do we track on those as a category in terms of compliance, in terms of trends in violations and so forth?
We track all of them. They're all required to have to submit their self-monitoring reports, comply with their waste discharge requirements. We have them in our CWICS database, California Integrated Water Quality System. Is that it? Maybe I'm missing the point of your question.
Yeah, I didn't ask it right. I'm looking for a summary information. I'm aware that they all have permits for discharge, but do we look at them as a category of understanding how the technology and the trend among the municipal operations and so forth, do we look at them as a category of dischargers?
In terms of compliance with their permit over time?
So that we can see look at landfill, we look at timber, we look at these different entities in terms of these groups, and they have some certain things in common. And I think, I'm looking at this list of violations, and almost half are wastewater treatment plants. So it just struck me that it would be very helpful, I think, to look at trends with wastewater treatment projects, plant operations, because as they come forward to us, we certainly look individually at their history. We do want to consider the track record in terms of maintaining their operations and keeping things and attending to past problems and not seeing the same violations come forward repeatedly.
Uh-huh.
I'm just curious if we would benefit from looking at more generally the trend with wastewater treatment plants. Certainly we're looking at aging infrastructure, we're looking at permits that get renewed over a period of time, and I personally don't have a sense of collectively how they look in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to know that when I see permits coming up for review. So if there was a way to summarize the information and identify some attributes or some of the trends that would be beneficial to us in looking at conditions that we put on permits or any way we can sort of encourage improvements beyond the individual track record that we're actually seeing them as a whole. Is that clear? I hope I'm making sense.
I'd have to think on the best way to do that. One thing to keep in mind, though, is that the mandatory minimum penalties only apply to NPDES permits, and that means discharges to surface waters.
Mm-hmm.
The wastewater treatment plants, I think it would be fair to say, are a disproportionately high percentage of the NPDES permits.
Mm.
In other words, we've got lots of wineries that are under requirements that do not discharge. They don't have an NPDES permit, just as an example.
Okay.
So you're looking at a skewed selection here.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't answer your question about how they're doing.
No, it doesn't, but that does help put this in context a little better. Yeah.
I would think what you might see anyway, since they're all aged differently,
mm-hmm.
some are new, some are aged,
mm-hmm.
that you've got this kind of continuum going where
mm-hmm.
you have problems with a plant, like we've had with some plants.
Mm-hmm.
You see a lot of violations. Then they retrofit, upgrade, clean up. That plant no longer becomes an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But others that have been aging along the way, they start to fall into that area where they're exceeding effluent limits, and
mm-hmm.
so we'd start to see the minimum required penalties pop up.
Well, part of the problem is actually not necessarily related to aging, and it has to do with tightening limitations. So, for example, with CMC, California Men's Colony, they have a brand new plant, and they've had difficulty balancing between chlorine violations, bacterial violations, and trihalomethanes. City of San Luis Obispo has had the same problem because the trihalomethanes.
Right, I noticed that
in
that item. Yeah,
and that's not necessarily related to the age of the facilities. It's just that it's a very tight standard, and that's one of the things about having an MPDS permit is typically because you're going to an aquatic environment, and a lot of times the standards for fish, for other aquatic organisms, is more stringent than drinking water standards. So that's reflected here with a lot of these violations. It's just a tougher standard compared to waste discharge requirements for a municipality that discharges to land or any other facility that discharges to land. But we can give some thought to how we might answer your questions about overall trends and that sort of thing, if you'll allow us to do that.
Okay. I appreciate that, and I do understand that yet another report. But, you know, it strikes me that we have, it is a substantial category of discharge. So I think it would be helpful to us. Thank you.
Okay. And we have a couple of cards.
We have a couple of speaker cards.